Welcome to the Small Caps Podcast, where we discuss news and information related to ASX-listed companies and financial markets, keeping investors informed. Note that the content in this podcast is not financial or investment advice, and be sure to head over to smallcaps.com.au to get the latest market news. Now, without further delay, here's today's podcast.
Welcome back to Small Caps. My name is Kerry Stevenson, and boy, have I got somebody special for you today. Mr. Rick Rule, who we haven't spoken to for a little while, and he's been very generous with his time and said he would like to talk to the Small Caps audience. That is you, my audience out there. Rick Rule, I like to call him an investor and a speculator, very successful one, I might add, who actually in the last uranium bull market did extremely well. So we're going to talk uranium, we're going to talk the macro economy. We're also, of course, going to cover precious metals and what's going on with that. Rick Rule, great to see you. Welcome to Small Caps.
A pleasure to be back with you, Kerry. Thank you for having me back.
Well, it's always good to hear your views on things. First of all, because if I look back at your career in the markets, formerly with Sprott, and now you have a company, ruleinvestmentmedia.com, which we'll talk about in a moment. But you have had quite a considerable amount of success over the years. And it's interesting to watch how you ran the success of the last uranium bull market, your success in precious metals. But before we get into specifics and some of the questions that have come through from viewers, Rick, let's talk more macro to start off with. Right now, a lot of people are talking about China, Evergrande, the big property company that is on the precipice at the moment with, what is it, $300 billion worth of debt. Will they be able to repay it? And is that going to affect global markets? So I'm feeling that there's a lot of hesitancy around the markets at the moment. What's your view on Evergrande? Is it an issue, or do you think the CCP will just work it all out?
I don't think Evergrande itself is an issue, but I think it's a symptom of a very large issue. The idea that 10,000 people in China, the people around the CCP, the top of the CCP, can adequately govern over a billion people seems like an odd supposition to me. China became great when Deng Xiaoping said to become rich is glorious, and loosened the control of the Chinese Communist Party over the Chinese people. The Chinese people had always been successful when they got out of China, when they were allowed to work for themselves and their families. And the liberalization unleashed by Deng Xiaoping has probably been the greatest economic event really since the Industrial Revolution, the urbanization of 600 million people, pardon me, and the unleashment of that creativity on the world. The regression from that liberalization, I think, is a very bad thing. With regards to Evergrande in particular, as I understand it, the aggregate debts are around $300 billion. Yeah. So if you assume that it isn't a total write-off, because it isn't, there's stuff, there's buildings, there's land, there will be a recovery. The last time anybody looked, the Chinese Communist Party had access to about $1.8 trillion in foreign reserves. So if you assume just for fun, a 35% write-off, you're talking about $100 billion against a kitty that's got $1.8 trillion in it. The question is gonna be who wins and who loses. Yeah. Clearly, the recapitalization of Evergrande won't take place at the Evergrande level. It'll take place among entities that pick up the pieces. So who will the bag holders be? Certainly the shareholders of Evergrande will be bag holders. And certainly some classes of creditors will be treated better than others. And I suspect that the assets too will go to state favored constituencies. It'll be a grand lesson, Kerry, in politics. Politics in the sense of the word, poly from the Latin for many, and tick from the English colloquial for small blood-sucking insect. This will be a politics party like none other, which I intend to watch. But in terms of this actually driving something in world markets, I think because it appeals to people's sentiment that it will cause perturbations, if that's the right phrase, in global markets. But a $100 billion hiccup against a $1.8 trillion kitty shouldn't be anything like unmanageable.
What do you think China's bigger game plan is? I mean, they are a large producer of gold. They have the yuan. There's digital currencies coming in. And more recently, they have banned cryptocurrencies throughout China, which has sent a wobble through that market. Rick, what do you think China, because China is a massive country with a massive economy. And, you know, here in Australia, of course, the iron ore price is a little bit pegged to the economy of China. What do you think their bigger picture is right now?
Well, if you take them at their word, they would like China's power and stature to reflect, if you will, their latent might. They would like to be important at a global level, economic, militarily. They have what they consider to be unfinished business with regards to land claims in places like Tibet and the South China Sea. They're obviously going to become more assertive. They obviously don't like the idea that they're going to be told what to do by anybody, be that Korea, be it Japan, be it the United States, be it India. I think, too, that Xi is in favor of an ascendant government. Ascendant governments, in my experience, always lead to lower living standards for the citizenry. And part of the ascendant government is increasing power at the center and decreasing individual freedom. The idea, as an example, that people could circumvent currency controls by mining Bitcoin, exporting the Bitcoin and turning that Bitcoin into gold or dollars or something else, without having to bribe a state official or at least ask permission, is something that from the CCP's point of view is inexcusable. On a different note, I think that they have been and continued to be investors in gold, not because they intend a gold-backed yuan. They don't intend that. It would reduce their power. But rather because they would like to be able to conduct business bilaterally in a medium of exchange that isn't the US dollar. The idea that they have to trade, as an example, with a neighbor like Vietnam or a different neighbor like Russia in US dollars must be mortifying to them. So I can understand perfectly the idea that they would be able to securitize bilateral trade or bilateral letters of credit in some medium other than the US dollar. Make no mistake, the idea that the Chinese are going to have a digital currency that's backed with gold is stupid. Having to have a currency that's backed in gold imposes a discipline on a government, a reduction in government power in favor of the holder of the currency. And that's the furthest thing from any government's mind. Yours? Mine or the Chinese. The bigger the government, the greater the deterioration in individual liberty. So unfortunately, for the next while, it would appear that China is headed in that direction.
As are most governments around the world with all of this, what I call the money printing phenomenon, the brrrr of the printing machine that seems to have no end.
That's a wonderful point. Any charges that I lay at the Chinese, I could just as easily lay at my own country. Comrade Biden, Comrade Trump et al.
Yep, Comrade Morrison down here as well, because we're not only locked up, but we are handing money over hand over fist, but no one seems to worry about that at all. Stock market's going up here in Australia, Rick. Property, it's insane. Do you see an end to this, or do you think governments, in order to stay in control, need to keep printing what I call the funny money, and as a result, which people, most people don't understand, some do, our purchasing power continues to decrease?
I expect there will have to be a reckoning or a series of reckonings. I'm an optimist, so I think we get through it with some pain. You know, we got through the 70s. The 70s had their own challenges, little things for Americans like the war in Vietnam. which we lost, the war on drugs, which we lost, the war on poverty, which we lost. Anyway, I digress.
The Taliban, which you lost.
That's right. I don't think that we have a circumstance with our economies as they are constituted that we can have free market interest rates, or that we can abandon quantitative easing, which, as you and I have discussed before, should more properly be called central bank counterfeiting, because that's what it is. And this is a viable policy tool as long as confidence remains. What would damage confidence? I don't know what the answer to that is, quite frankly. But when you look at the arithmetic as an example around artificially low interest rates, from a historical perspective, it's extremely stark. I won't deal with the numbers in Australia because I'm less familiar with them. But in my country, a few things come out to me. The world's benchmark savings instrument is and has been for many, many years the U.S. 10-year treasury. People who aren't American object to that, but ours is the deepest, most liquid currency in the world. And the U.S. 10-year treasury is alleged to be riskless. We'll come back to that. Right now, the U.S. 10-year treasury yields about 125 basis points, 1.25%. Historically, over three or four decades, the yield on the U.S. 10-year treasury after inflation has been positive. If you look at the U.S. government's stated rate of inflation, it's 5.5%. To have 100 basis point, pardon me, real yield, it would mean that the yield on the U.S. 10-year treasury would have to be 6.5%. Yeah. It's difficult for me to understand how federal, state, and local governments could afford a quadrupling of their interest charge. But the situation gets even stranger, Kerry. In the US, the 30-year mortgage, which is 30-year fixed mortgage, which is how most people buy their homes, has been priced at a premium to the US 10-year treasury. So if you put 100 basis point or 1% premium to the historical interest rate, all of a sudden the 30-year fixed is 7.5%. Up from 3 and change today. The ability of new home buyers in particular to afford homes with a tripling of the interest charge, I think let's be too a little bit non-confrontational, and let's just say that it would be interesting. Very, very interesting. The point of all this is that I don't think that your economy or ours, as they're currently constituted, can afford market interest rates. And in order to adjust to a market interest rate world, there would have to be a substantial readjustment. Not what the big thinkers have in mind when they call it a reset. This would be something entirely different. I don't know what it would be. Like my friend Doug Casey says, it would be interesting to watch, preferably from somewhere far away, on a big screen TV.
We gotta love Doug Casey.
I do.
Rick, no one's talking about inflation, really, are they? And I speak to people and they're like, oh no, inflation's not, but it's here. It's just no one's talking about it.
You know, Kerry, I think I have this figured out. People's expectation of the future is set by their experience in the immediate past.
Yeah.
And the last 40 years that we've lived through have been extraordinarily benign. In 1981, the U.S. 10-year rate was 15.6.
That's right.
Now it's 1.2. So we've lived through a period of falling interest rates. We've lived through a period of increased liquidity. We've lived through a period of increasing real estate prices, increased securities prices, and we've been trained that things just get better and better. We've been trained, too, to believe that government, not individual initiative, is responsible for this. You know, I guess in Australia, your government must have found the Pilbara. They must have found the Queensland coal fields. All of the good which happened in Australia is obviously due to your government. The same in the United States, of course. Yeah. If your expectation of the future, pardon me, is set by your experience in the immediate past, what the immediate past tells you, 40 years of immediate past tells you, is to be brave. But things change. We're seldom prepared for change. I remember through the decade of the 80s, which was characterized by falling interest rates and falling prices, that because of 15 years of inflation, prior years of inflation, the expectation all through the 80s, when we weren't experiencing inflation, was inflation. After 40 years, that fear has been beaten out of us.
Right.
It's really pernicious, though, Carrie, if you think about both inflation and low interest rates, what happens to savers?
They get decimated.
They get absolutely slaughtered. If you look again at the US 10-year treasury, somebody's getting paid 125 basis points in a currency that's depreciating by 5.5% a year. In other words, savers are losing 4% a year compounded. My friend Jim Grant calls that return-free risk. At the end of 10 years, including the compounding, the saver has lost almost two-thirds of his or her wealth. I guess the upside of this, if you're a big government person, is that for the first time in my life and yours, Carrie, the government is telling you the truth. If you give them money, they will give you back less 10 years from now than you have today. That's their solemn promise, and they're going to keep it.
But most people don't actually view it that way, because the majority of people out there, and it's not a shame, but it's kind of a worry for me that the majority of people think that they've got to save. Like, for example, here in Australia, Rick, with the property market continuing to be on fire and out of control, the people that don't fully understand this are just trying to save to keep up, and in fact don't realize that they're going backwards. What would you say to those people?
Well, perversely, I would say keep saving, but invest while you save. I think true too, Carrie, that despite the fact that your cash savings generates you a negative real yield, perversely, you have to keep holding some cash. Because if we have a liquidity squeeze, that cash will give you, hopefully, both the courage and the means to take care of to take advantage of a liquidity squeeze, rather than being taken advantage of, despite the fact that I know that my own cash holdings are costing me 4% a year compounded, I have fairly high levels of cash. The reason for that was 2008. When the 2008 crash happened, I was similarly cashed up. And the consequence of that is that 2008, 2009, and 2010 were extremely pleasant for me. When other people had to sell, I got to buy. I consider for investors and speculators, not for savers, but for investors and speculators who have large cash balances, that the negative interest rate that you suffer through is a form of option premium. It gives you the ability, should, as an example, major equity indexes fall by 50%, to do some well-timed buying.
What do you think? Sorry to interrupt you, Rick. You mentioned a liquidity squeeze. Just expand on that a little bit for me, because at the moment, people are not seeing that. The markets are going up and asset prices are going up and everyone's living in this warm, fuzzy bubble. Do you think that this can go on for a lot longer? We've spoken about this before, Rick. Do you think that the liquidity squeeze will come? You say that you've got cash at the moment, which indicates to me that you think that there could be something not too far away.
Yeah, I do. And I'm not sure what it is. You know, the nature of a black swan, as an example, is that it's always unexpected. I'm embarrassed to say that in 2006, before the 2008 events in the United States around real estate securities happened, that I was driving on the 405 freeway in California up to Los Angeles Airport, and there was a huge billboard on the east side of the road. It said, borrow 125% of the value of your home. Bad credit, okay.
Goodness me.
And I remember myself as a lender thinking, I don't think this has a happy ending. Was I smart enough to do anything about it? No. And so my suspicion is that it's more likely than not, not certain, more likely than not, that there will be some event which causes at least a hiccup of faith in the current circumstance. I don't know what that would be. I don't know what it could be. It would have to be something of greater order of magnitude than Evergrande, maybe a series of Evergrandes. You know, certainly the Chinese economy, as an example, is alleged to be levered to 3x GDP. So while there is room for an Evergrande, there isn't room for a series of Evergrandes, even with the $1.8 trillion in cash in the sidelines. but I really don't know what it is or what it could be. What I do know, do I know it? Well, let's approach it differently. In a fairly recent talk, Warren Buffett said that four times during his stewardship of Berkshire Hathaway, that it's fallen 40% or more over 18 months. So arguably the finest, strongest, best run, most diversified company on the planet, four times in 50 years has fallen by more than 40%.
Wow.
If a company that is that strong is that susceptible to the whims of the market, what can you say about the broad market, which is, let's just say, arguably somewhat less well run than Berkshire Hathaway? Could the market decline for 30 or 40% for no reason whatsoever? I don't see why not. Given that I think it's likely that more and more people will be concerned about precisely the arithmetic that you and I went through in this interview, mm-hmm. my suspicion is that it's more likely than not that people will become more cautious. And I suspect that we will see sometime in the next 5 years, let's just call it an interesting shock to the equities market. Let's think too, Kerry, about the circumstance that would happen if there was a broader realization of the truth.
Yeah.
Quantitative easing is counterfeiting.
Mm.
I mean, it is a simple truth.
Yep.
Or let's say that the Australian government or the US government gave a bond auction and no one came. People forget the rise of Roger Douglas, a Labor politician in New Zealand. Oh. That didn't come about because New Zealand's dairy farmers were eager to give up welfare and price supports. It happened because New Zealand was functionally bankrupt.
Sorry, you just go back a moment because I'm not sure about this story. And I'm not sure our listeners will be either.
Well, Roger Douglas was the Labor Prime Minister who was able to fashion the economic reforms that propelled New Zealand so well over the last three decades. A Labor politician wasn't predisposed to end subsidies, reduce regulation, cut tax, and do all the things he had to do. He did it because he didn't have a second choice. New Zealand was the first developed nation in the world that had to threaten to default. Similarly, the economic reforms that you saw in Canada in the early part of the decade of the 80s by Jean Chrétien didn't happen because he suddenly got a dose of Austrian economics. It happened because I think it was first Ontario Hydro, and later the government of Canada came to U.S. equity, U.S. debt markets, and the bond buyer said, no, thank you. No more money.
Yeah.
Could this happen to a broader range of credits? In other words, could private bond buyers refuse to buy bonds? And could the market shut on quantitative easing? If we had a U.S. Treasury auction, let's say that the U.S. Treasury went out to raise, you know, some paltry amount of money, like they do $50, $60 billion. And let's say that they came back with bids for $15 billion, and they had to counterfeit $45 billion. I think the impact of that on capital markets would be substantial. Am I saying it's going to happen? Eventually, yes, I think it's going to happen.
And I think that that's the issue. Eventually it's going to happen, but how do people manage that process in the meanwhile? And as you said earlier, it's about confidence in the moment. People are very confident in the markets. They're very confident in what's going on. So who knows what's going to go on? All we can do, and what I often say to people, is you have to hedge and diversify. And in
that's correct.
And in that, I actually reached out to a number of people. We've talked about the big picture. Rick, if it's all right with you, I'd like to go a little bit closer into some of the commodity sectors that our listeners are very interested in. And in fact, Niraj wants to talk about uranium. Now, you have been a uranium bull, both in the past bull market where, ladies and gentlemen, Rick timed it 4 years early and made a substantial you won't say killing, but he has a big smile on his face right now. And he's been saying for a couple of years now that he is bullish on uranium again. And it seems to me that the uranium market is back. Now, is it back briefly? And Neeraj says, what, Rick, is your uranium price target for next year? And he also, I'll get into iron ore in a minute, but let's just talk uranium for the moment. Are you bullish? Do you see that this is just the start, or have we hit the highs and it's going to settle from here?
The answer is somewhere in between, Carrie.
Okay.
When you and I started talking about uranium in these interviews 2 years ago, nobody cared. Everybody hated it, which is precisely what I liked about it.
Yeah.
The arithmetic around uranium, you'll note that I like math. The arithmetic around uranium was and is very impressive. In those days, the price of uranium was about $20 a pound.
Mm-hmm.
And it cost the industry, fully loaded, not just mine site costs, but exploration, G&A, cost of capital, about $60 a pound to make the stuff. So the industry is making it for 60, they're selling it for 20. They're losing $40 a pound and they're doing it 130 million times a year. It got sort of boring, Carrie.
Yeah.
So it was pretty clear that the industry couldn't continue to make something when they were suffering that kind of losses.
Yeah.
Mercifully for humankind, we had pretty good storehouse of uranium that we were able to use to finance, if you will, the production deficit. But it was clear that once we used up that above ground surplus, that one of two things would happen. Either the price of uranium would go up or the lights would go out. Those were the only two choices. Even in the United States, where we believe we're too rich to need uranium, you know, that we can get by on, you know, things like solar in the state of Washington, where the sun doesn't shine, wind, which doesn't blow constantly except in the legislature. 20% of our baseload power is nuclear.
Is that right?
14% of our total supply is nuclear. So if you believed, Carrie, in the United States that 5 years hence, the lights would go on when you hit a switch, you believed in higher uranium prices. Not too long ago, my former employer took control of something called Uranium Participation Corp. We changed this form of organization to a trust, a business we know something about because we have about $12 billion in assets in our precious metals trusts. And we set about tightening the supply picture in uranium. We were fortunate in that the Sprott name and the uranium narrative attracted a lot of attention. And I would suggest that largely through the success of the now Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, that the spot price in uranium advanced from $28 a pound to $50 a pound. From my point of view, it might have happened too far too fast because I don't know really what the above ground inventories are. The industry is extremely opaque. But yeah, make no mistake, Carrie, if the total cost to produce uranium worldwide 4 years ago was $60 a pound, this very inflation that you talk about makes that number go up every year. And to the extent that the uranium price doesn't keep pace with the cost of producing uranium, including the cost of capital, the lights will go out. I suspect that an incentive price for uranium is in the $75 range, that the carrying case for uranium is about $70. So right now we're at about 48. The price does not need to go up in the very near term, but it may. What makes markets go up in the near term is more buyers than sellers.
Mm.
And to the extent that the 2 year and 3 year narrative works on buyers, that is to the extent that people say, listen, the price is 50 now, it has to go to 70. So I have a locked in 30 or 35% gain over 2 or 3 years, and it might clear much higher than that. To the extent that that causes people to want to buy it now to lock in that form of gain, then the price goes higher sooner. To the extent that it doesn't, then the price goes higher later. But what's more important, Carrie, in the intermediate term than our trust is that now there appears to be the political will in Japan to restart their nuclear fleet. the decline in uranium prices was really a function of the disaster at Fukushima and the decision by the Japanese to shut down 51 reactors countrywide.
Yeah.
They now have 10 reopened, and the Prime Minister of Japan has said, well, the country needs to transition off nuclear eventually, that nuclear is a bridge fuel, that nuclear can provide secure baseload power because of its energy density, mm-hmm. while generating no carbon whatsoever.
And that's the key as well.
It's hugely important to the extent that the Japanese nuclear fleet turns back on. Two important things happen. Most of the above ground inventory available for sale on the market today, I believe, is Japanese. The utilities that owned all that uranium weren't going to burn it, so they wanted to do something with it. You all of a sudden turn all that supply into demand, and the demand is very substantial, about 20 million pounds a year. So we stand the chance of having, in effect, a twofer. The Sprott Physical Uranium Trust tightening up the spot market. I'm tempted to call it the Sprott market in the near term. And the Japanese coming back into the market and tightening up the term market. If that happened, I think you'd see $70 to $75 without breaking a sweat. It's important to note too, Kerry, that markets can really overshoot in uranium. Because the industry doesn't have the ability in the near term to respond to pricing signals. Restarting the great Canadian mines, MacArthur River, Cigar Lake, which have been well maintained and shut down, could easily take 18 to 24 months, 2 years, while then taking the yellow cake that came out of those mines and converting that to nuclear fuel could take another year. So to the extent that you began the whole process in motion right now, it would still take 3 years to increase supply meaningfully. I don't think supply will increase meaningfully until you see the term, not the spot market, priced in the $55 to $65 level so that these restarts could generate reasonable returns for shareholders.
Well, we've got a couple of questions here. One from Nick Vancouver, he wants to know if we're in for a period of consolidation before the next leg up. And also, Rick Rule, which one do you go for? Which do you think are areas best positioned for gain, explorers or producers?
I think it depends on what kind of gain somebody wants. Mm. I think the producers are substantially cheaper based on fundamentals than the explorers are. And everyone needs to understand, narrative aside, an increasing price of uranium shouldn't impact the supplier, the explorers, all that much, because if the price of something you don't have any of goes up, it shouldn't impact your valuation. Now, the truth is, in bull markets, price expectations are set by narratives. And so while the big companies should increase faster than the small ones, hope springs eternal, and the penny dreadfuls, the $10 million market caps can go up, pardon the pun, but explosively based on narrative, related but not dependent on the uranium price. One thing that's different in this market compared to the one that I enjoyed so much in the decade 2000 to 2010 was that the starting market capitalizations we had there were just pathetically cheap. My biggest twin was Paladin. We started that romp with a market cap of 1.6 million Australian. Some of the uranium juniors have president's salaries that resemble the market cap of Paladin at that point in time. It's difficult to get a 10,000% gain if you're starting with $150 or $200 million market cap. Mm. If you're going to get a $2 billion market cap, you're going to have a real company, not a penny dreadful explorer. So people need to tamper their expectation of the percentage gain they hope to enjoy simply because of the market capitalizations now being so much larger. People might need to tamper their expectations anyway. It seems as though people believe that the experience some people had with Bitcoin, $10 to $40,000 is somehow normal and natural in financial markets. From my own particular point of view, when I look at the finest of the uranium companies, Kazatomprom, I sort of believe that I'm going to get at least a double. I might get a triple, and I'm going to get a 5% yield while I wait. From my own point of view, that's extremely attractive. But when I've shared that point of view on various podcasts, you know, people have said, who gives a damn? I'm not in this game for a double. I get it. But if you're passing up the obvious in search of the nebulous,
yeah.
You know, it might not have a happy ending for you.
And I tend to agree with that. Do you think the mainstream narrative on nuclear is going to change? Because post Fukushima, there was all this concern about, you know, nuclear, you know, it's going to kill us all, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think that's gradually changing, both from a general investment speculator side of things, as well as the government narrative? Do you think that's starting to change?
Yes, slowly. Now, understand that you and I exist in a world where people actually care about this.
Hmm.
Most people in the world couldn't spell uranium. They couldn't spell nuclear. and they think that power comes from a toggle switch. You know, you have voices as diverse as Warren Buffett and Bill Gates that have said that the only hope that we have for a reduced carbon future is uranium. Neither of those guys are particularly fans of the extractive industries. Elon Musk has said the same thing. It depends on where you go for narrative. If where you go for narrative is Angela Merkel, who shut down her nuclear fleet
immediately had to
begin buying electricity from other places, particularly France, which generated theirs from nuclear. Or if you get it from Ms. Thornburg, the noted economist and nuclear physicist from Sweden, or Jacinda Ardern, for that matter, you're going to have a very, very, very different point of view. I would suggest to you that if you take it from people who are either scientifically, economically, or environmentally literate, that nuclear will have a place in our power mix for a long time. The other thing the big thinkers forget, Carrie, and this actually does burn me a bit. I guess that's the wrong phrase to use with nuclear. But anyway, there's 1.2 billion people on Earth, Carrie, who have no electricity whatsoever, no access to electricity at all. There are 2 billion other people that are extremely poor that want to live like you and I live. And we live very energy intensive lives. Yeah. And the way that you want to live for the next 10 years and the way that I want to live for the next 10 years involves us using more electric power too. So when people talk about the electric future, when they talk about solar, I say, bring it on. Wind, that too. Geothermal, I'm all over it. We're going to need more power of every kind in order to enable 3 billion people on Earth to live in a manner that more closely resembles their aspirations.
Yeah.
And I don't think that we have the luxury of saying to 3 billion people on Earth, we've got ours. Suffer in darkness.
Yeah.
I don't feel good about that. Nor, frankly, do I think, and I'm not being funny about this, any of the so-called big thinkers, if they thought through their big thoughts, would think that they were justified in consigning 3 billion people on Earth to energy poverty.
Yeah, and you're right, Rick, because energy poverty is an issue. Now, listen, I have so many questions to ask you. Let me just summarize it. From your point of view with uranium, you believe that it is in a bit of a bull market. You prefer that, correct me if I'm wrong, producers are cheaper than explorers at the moment, perhaps to have a little bit of a mix, but you like the producers, and that you think that the mainstream narrative will eventually change. But you're pretty bullish on uranium at the moment.
I need to say one thing. I think in the very near term, Carrie, it's ahead of itself.
Okay.
It doesn't mean that it will have a hiatus, but it wouldn't surprise me to see the uranium stocks and the uranium price itself run into the same sort of cyclical decline that you have seen in the gold stocks.
Right.
Will it be as deep? Will it be as long? I don't know. All I know is that the price of the stuff ran from $30 to $50
pretty quickly.
pretty quickly. You know, and I know that the backside of a parabolic chart can be just as steep as the front side, but much less fun.
So possible correction.
Yep.
To come, but in the long term, it sounds pretty good.
Arithmetic works in the long
term. Arithmetic works. All right. Going on to copper, which is another one, because you have an investment in Hot Chili, ASX code, ladies and gentlemen, HCH over there in South America. Your future for copper?
I love the copper business. It's treated me so well over the years. That doesn't say it hasn't punished me from time to time either. I was surprised to see the copper price run as fast as it ran from sort of US 280 to US $4. Looking out 5 years, Carrie, I think the copper price will surprise us all to the upside, not just because of the demand for copper with regards to electrification around the world, not to do with electric vehicles, although that will help, but rather because as a society, we have underinvested in copper exploration and copper capital projects for 30 years. Copper around the world comes from very long of tooth deposits. Grasberg is 30 years old, Olympic Dam, 20 years old, Chuquicamata, 110 years old, Escondida, 40 years old. These deposits are older than I am, Carrie. And there isn't the project pipeline to refresh them. When I was a young man, we looked at a reasonable grade for an open cast copper mine at about 1.5%. The global average now is less than 0.5%.
Is it really? Oh my goodness.
Yes, ma'am. And so I believe that no matter what we do, we will experience systematic shortages of copper 5 years from now, unless we have a recession that verges on a depression that kills demand. The combination of the electrification of the world, the increasing electrification in high-income countries, and the lack of investment over 30 years, combined with the difficulty in permitting new copper deposits, means that almost no matter what we do, save a depression, we're going to have pretty grotesque supply-demand imbalances 5 years from now.
And what was it about HCH that caught your attention?
Well, for the first thing, there was this young Australian guy, Christian Easterday.
Lovely boy.
Didn't know what he couldn't do. Yeah. You know, I'd been around that part of Chile for 30 years, and I knew that you couldn't break any of those assets out of the Chilean government. It would never happen. Okay. Particularly, it wouldn't happen to a foreigner. Christian knew a lot less about Chile than I did. He didn't cause himself any trouble, so he succeeded where I would have failed because he didn't know it was impossible. He did the impossible.
Right.
Then when the copper price fell, Hot Chile was broke. Christian didn't know, nor did his backer, Murray Black, that if you have no money in a capital-intensive business, you're toast. They just decided somehow they weren't broke. And they got through a down period. Christian decided that the right thing to do when you're broke is to go big. So rather than liquidate assets to pay his salary, he went out and he bought a private deposit next door to his, used money he didn't have to drill it, and made a major discovery within 30 kilometers of the coast. So you can ship the stuff at low altitude, unlike other deposits that are 4,000 or 5,000 meters high.
Yeah.
He's done an amazing job.
Yeah, he has.
The deposit is still, from my point of view, grade challenged, but the deposit is so large that the probability that he won't be able to find a starter deposit is now low. I'm not looking at Hot Chile as being something that's going to contribute to global copper supplies next year or the year after. I'm looking at it as a must-own asset 4 or 5 years from now, when the impending shortages of copper are no longer impending, but are in fact current.
Yeah, they're real.
And when a delineated deposit close to coast with power, sealed roads, ports, all of those things in place, it'll be a very valuable asset.
I'm sure Christian, I'll make sure that he knows that we've had this conversation. I'm sure he'll be delighted with your comments.
All of it, including his unrealistic personality, will make him laugh.
And you know what? He's a terrific guy. I've interviewed Christian. He is a terrific guy. And you know what? He has kept going where others, as you said, would have said, let's give up. He's been very tenacious. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. Right. We cannot finish without a look at gold and silver. Aileen Amy says, what's going on with gold and silver? And also wants to know what your favorite Aussie gold stocks are, whether you follow too many of the Aussie gold stocks. I'm not sure. But what's going on, Rick? It's
We follow the Aussie gold and silver stocks very closely. Traditionally, the Australian gold companies, it pains me to say it, but they've been substantially better run than their North American counterparts. And if you look now at the free cash margins enjoyed by the Australian producers, they are also better values by and large than the North American producers are. Going back to the original question, as the malaise in the gold market continues, I get more bullish. I won't own a lot more gold and silver, and I want to own a lot more gold and silver stocks. So perversely, I am hoping that an asset that I own a lot of declines in price because I'd like to own a lot more. I honestly believe a couple things. The wind is clearly in gold sails now.
Okay.
Gold moves, precious metals move because people are concerned about the efficacy of their purchasing power in fiat instruments. Mm-hmm. And anybody who isn't concerned about receiving 1.2 basis points in a currency that's depreciating by 5.5% a year is somebody that needs to go back to grade one math. That's just as simple as it is, particularly when the powers that be don't have any conceivable way out of the trap in the near term. Does this happen in 2021, 2022? I don't know. What I do know is that while it may not be imminent, it is inevitable. We've talked before, Carrie, about the fact that I really prefer to ask myself questions where the answer begins with when, right, not if.
Yeah.
The second thing that your listeners need to know is that cyclical declines in secular bull markets are common. Every bull market I've ever experienced has had three or four or five of them. They might unnerve you, but it's not the job of a bull market to make you sleep well. You need to understand that the circumstance that we're going through is a circumstance that occurred in 2003. It's a circumstance that occurred in 1977. It's absolutely normal and natural. Every time I scare myself, which is not infrequently, I go and I look at the Barron's Gold Mining Index,
yes,
which is a 65-year running index that's the largest and most inclusive gold equities index in the world. And you can see that the circumstance that we're experiencing today is nothing that our predecessors, that I myself didn't experience in the 1970 to 1981 bull market or the 2000 to 2011 bull market.
Yeah.
The third thing that I would leave you with, and this may be less appropriate for Australian speculators, but in the second half of a precious metals bull market, which I think we're approaching, traditionally, the price action is led by gold, but silver takes over in the second half. The gold bug is a pretty committed maniac, but the silver bug is truly a manic depressive. And when momentum takes over in precious metals bull markets, silver traditionally moves further and faster than gold. And the most constrained asset of all is high quality silver stocks. Mm-hmm. When the generalist money moves into high quality silver stocks, I've seen it happen twice before in my career. Doug Casey describes it as attempting to siphon Hoover Dam through a garden hose. You could say Sydney Harbor through a garden hose, I suspect.
Okay. Yep.
Simply that there isn't enough market capitalization in the space to hold the money. Just because it happened before doesn't mean it's going to happen again, but I think it's much more likely than not to have happened. And with regards to both gold and silver equities, if you value them on the net present value of their proven cash flows at today's prices and costs, and you take that net present value number against their enterprise value, market capitalization plus cash minus debt, these companies are the cheapest that they've ever been in my career.
In your career?
In my career. Does that mean they couldn't get cheaper? No, of course not. But at some point, stuff is cheap enough. You're shopping for a coat for winter. It's been marked down from 400 to 200. It's cold outside. Do you wait to see if they're going to mark it down to 150 or you buy the damn coat? I get this one. I've trained 45 years for it. Probably my last active bull market. I'm going to enjoy the hell out of it.
Sounds like you're having a bit of fun. Aylin asked also your favorite Aussie gold stocks, please. Let's put silver in there as well.
Yeah, I'm not sure I have a favorite Aussie gold stock because I like so many of them.
No, that's good.
I don't think that you need to err on the side of the little ones to get torque. I believe there's torque in the big ones. I believe the gold price is going to go up. I believe that progress in the Australian dollar is going to be moderated, which means that the company's costs will go down. At the same time, their margins will increase. And they're cheap enough already. Yep. These guys are generating mountains of cash. And the institutional investors are loath to let them reinvest it because of the huge mistakes they made in the decade 2000 to 2010. So they either have to increase their dividends or engage in equity buybacks or ultimately participate in mergers and acquisition. Option one, option two, and option three are all very good for share prices.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we've seen a couple of the big ones like Northern Star and Evolution. Their share prices are probably the lowest that they've been for quite some time.
It is unbelievable to see the share price malaise happen at the same time that you look at the interplay between the balance sheet and the income statement on a quarterly basis.
Yeah.
These guys are piling up cash. Piling up cash. My friend Doug Casey again describes earned dividends as outward manifestations of inward grace. And you are going to see these outward manifestations of inward grace across the mid-tier and top tier of the Australian producers.
So buckle up, I would say. Buckle up is what...
Carrie, it's so weird. If you look back a year and a quarter ago, when these stocks were often priced at twice the price that they are today, people were knocking down the doors to buy them.
Mm-hmm.
Now that they're 50% off, people couldn't care less. You either believe the gold thesis...
You either
believe in arithmetic or you don't. If you do believe in the gold thesis, if you do believe that retained earnings are a sign of virtue, you have to own these things. I'm absolutely delighted that other people don't feel this way.
Because people don't feel that way, Rick is having an absolute ball because, as he says, he's enjoying the pullback in not only the gold price, but the gold stocks, because that's his playground and he's having a lot of fun while everybody else is looking the wrong way.
Yeah, so, there's probably 50 million potential competitors that are sitting on the sidelines.
Yep.
A lot of them richer and smarter than me. And I'm delighted, frankly, Carrie, not to be competing with them. I hope 4 years from now or 5 years from now, if the gold price has tripled and they're all climbing into the market and the market's demanding liquidity, that I can, service them.
You can be one of those people that says, oh, let me help you out.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, Rick, we're running out of time. I want to talk briefly about Rural Investment Media, because a lot of people would have known you from your days at Sprott. Now you're much more independent, much more able to speak freely, and I so appreciate your time with me here today. Now, ruralinvestmentmedia.com, ladies and gentlemen, it's got a lot of information there, but explain to our listeners what it is. And I believe you have an offer for them under your new Rural Investment Media banner.
Yeah, let's do the offer first, because that's pretty straightforward. Okay. Anybody who's listening to these interviews, who cares what I think about their specific natural resource portfolio, let's get away from global macro now and do what matters, what you own. If you go to ruralinvestmentmedia.com, you'll find a drop-down sheet and you can enter your natural resource portfolio. Please, no cryptos. Please, no pot stocks. Please, no tech stocks, just natural resource stocks. I'll rank them 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. I'll comment on individual issues where I think my comments might have value. And if you mention charts in the question line, I will include the Barron's Gold Mining Index, the best equity index in the precious metals business I know. And I'll include, too, a 100-year commodity chart that tells you just how cheap commodities are relative to other economic asset classes going back 100 years. I don't know why everybody in Australia doesn't have this chart on their refrigerator. You know, as an iron producer.
Timmy, I don't have it on my refrigerator, but the minute you send it to me, I will pop it on the fridge.
Get to it, ma'am. I will do all that. As to Rural Investment Media, I really don't know what I'm going to do with it, Carrie. I know that I'm going to do more of what you do. I'm, among other things, I'm going to do an interview series, 20 long, of living legends.
Brilliant.
People who have built multi-billion dollar mining and oil and gas companies from a standing start. Not so much allowing them to chest beat, but rather asking them about how the lessons that they learned building these companies are appropriate to investors and how investors can use those lessons to make money. You know, I'm really looking forward to that. The other thing is I've been asked for 45 years now, aggressively in the last 30 years, to write a book on natural resource investing. I've decided I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to do is what is currently outlined as a 32-part video series, where rather than write a book, I talk a book. And that will be available very likely as freeware at Rural Investment Media, given that I don't have any printing cost, any postage cost, any handling cost. I'll give it away. To what end? I don't know. It's just something that amuses me. I see so many people making unnecessary mistakes, the same mistakes, by the way, that I made in my teens and 20s, and they're correctable mistakes for the most part. So I look forward to those two projects, and those two projects will happen inside Rural Investment Media.
Now, just going back to the offer on the natural resource stocks, do they go to ruralinvestmentmedia.com, and there's a, where do they go?
You can't miss it. Ruralinvestmentmedia.com. You will see it. Enter your resource stocks here.
Okay, great. So, ladies and gentlemen, you heard it here. And look, Rick, one of the things I would like to say as well, you're giving back so much to the community at the moment, and your time that you spend with me and our listeners is so much appreciated, because your wealth of knowledge, the history that you've had, and what you, how you help others is so much appreciated. I, for one, always learn from you, and it's been great to have you on Small Caps today. And I hope to see you in the near future. Thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime, Carrie. I look forward to it. Thank you.